2023, around 17,000 Afghan babies and mothers are expected to suffer from severe acute malnutrition, while over 2.3 million children may suffer from moderate acute malnutrition. The UN body adds that an estimated 28.3 million people, which comprises two-thirds of Afghanistan's population, need urgent relief assistance.
We are a family of 10. My husband is a shoemaker. This malnourished child of mine is 3 months old. Two of my children died as a result of wasting and stunting.
Afghan people's miseries are growing day by day. Unemployment, poverty, and famine have gripped the society, with poor and middle-class households being hit hard. Many have brought their malnourished kids here, and I think it is because they have no food in their houses. We are calling on the global community not to ignore Afghans amid political and economic crises.
Concerns are on the rise among Afghans over their isolation from the international community and major cuts in global aid following the Taliban's takeover and U.S. withdrawal from their country.
Afghanistan has one of the highest rates of malnutrition in the world. Afghans are calling on the global community not to leave them alone amid poverty and hunger. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Thursday, Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah warned the United States and its allies that its attempts to stir chaos in the country will not be fruitful.
I'll tell the U.S., if you create chaos in Lebanon, then you will witness chaos in the entire region. If you target our people with your conspiracies, then we will use our power and arms to make you feel pain, even if this means war against your beloved Israel.
The leader of the resistance group also said that the 2019 protests in Lebanon were merely part of a U.S. ploy, which took advantage of weaknesses in the country as part of a new strategy after the failure of direct military invasions.
Lebanon has, from the year 2019, been the target of a new U.S. plot. First, it's a plot to eradicate the achievements and the victories of the resistance and its martyrs. And second, it's a plot to take Lebanon back to being under the hegemony of the U.S., which wants to impose its conditions on the country's domestic affairs and its conditions on relations with the enemy.
Nasrallah, who addressed people during the memorial ceremony of three of Hezbollah's martyred leaders, also emphasized that supporters of the resistance group who are suffering from economic crisis will continue to support the group. Observers believe that all stalemates in Lebanon, whether the inability to elect a president or lack of economic reforms, are all the result of a wave of subtle interference by the U.S.
The U.S. is pressurizing Lebanon economically to impose its conditions and bring to power a president who is loyal to Washington and is not friendly with the resistance, so that it can implement its policies by means of soft power. Having said that, it would not seem that the U.S. has launched a war on Lebanon or the resistance. While it would seem this is an internal Lebanese affair, this is where the threat lies in their plots.
Nasrallah also touched upon the issue of offshore oil and gas exploration, saying Hezbollah will hinder Israel's production of gas from oil fields should procrastination by the companies who have contracts with Lebanon continue.
After assassination of any prominent leader of Hezbollah, the resistance would go through a landmark transformation. Now, in light of what analysts see as a massive U.S. attempt to choke Lebanon politically and economically, the resistance progress is unhindered. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
A little crumbling space filled with dirt and garbage. Rohingya refugee camp on the outskirts of New Delhi is no more than an open prison for the members of the community who face constant threats and intimidation from law enforcement agencies. They say all their activities are being monitored and reported to the local police station on a daily basis. A member of the community is given that task, but that is not the only trouble.
My son was picked up by police along with his wife from outside our shanty 4 months ago. He did not commit any crime. He has been in a detention center for a long time now. I'm worried for him. The UN Refugee Agency says they are working on the case, but nothing has been done so far. He was working as a day laborer in nearby colonies. He did nothing wrong. I humbly urge for his release. We thank God that India gave us shelter, but there is constant fear of detention in the camp.
In recent weeks, the Delhi High Court ordered a joint inspection of the Rohingya Detention Center in New Delhi by officials of concerned agencies over the alleged lack of basic amenities. The court was hearing a plea of a female refugee who is facing bad health conditions due to the lack of basic facilities in the detention center.
My brother recently got married and he was detained just 3 days after his wedding along with his wife. Since then, he's in a detention center. My mother is blind and she cries every day for him. We have been living here for years and we are grateful to India for giving us refugees. I sell vegetables on the streets and similarly other men do menial work, but we are scared now since detention fear is looming across camps.
Most refugees here have heartbreaking tales of the past, and those memories of carnage and exodus are haunting them. Based on official estimates, India is home to some 40,000 Rohingya refugees, but independent reports put the figures at hundreds of thousands. Most of the refugees I spoke with feared that their identity would be disclosed, given the high risk of detention. Scores have also gone into hiding at undisclosed locations across India. They have a horrific tales of separation from their families amid a persistent deportation campaign and an intensified crackdown against the community. Munawar Zaman in the outskirts of New Delhi.
Heads of NGOs in Syria have gathered to loudly voice an urgent need for help. In Damascus, more than 550 NGOs read out a statement before media outlets calling on the U.S. to lift its unilateral economic sanctions on Syria, explaining the years-long siege deprived Syria from its basic needs and equipment needed to rescue those affected by the deadly earthquake.
Today, I apologize to the victims who we heard their voices under the rubble but could not help. Our volunteers were hearing them but couldn't save them because we do not have necessary equipment. 12 years of sanctions left us without required vehicles and rescue equipment. Many people died under the rubble because of those sanctions.
Speakers say the recent ease of U.S. sanctions on Syria to help humanitarian aid reach the country is not effective. That's because banks, companies, and governments around the world are still reluctant to engage with Syria, as they might face legal obstacles in the future. Western states claim that food and medicine is not included in their list of sanctions, but the reality is vastly different.
Sanctions have affected my life, my neighbors, and all Syrian people. We don't have fuel or electricity, and this has raised prices of everything like food and medicine. This is unbearable, especially after the earthquake.
We all here came to say lift economic sanctions. This country cannot stand any more suffering. Even before the earthquake, we were collapsing economically. Those sanctions are only affecting the ordinary people, not the government.
Here, rescue workers are in a battle against time. The death toll keeps rising, and those who could get away from the earthquake are now struggling to survive with a lack of food and shelter. Syrians say it's about time the U.S. and its Western allies end the economic siege that has caused enormous pain and suffering for innocent citizens. They ask for a just and fair world where humanity comes first before all political agendas. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
We're used to the revolving door of Westminster politics with prime ministers coming and going at dizzying speed. North of the border, things have been much more stable for many years, until this week.
In my head and in my heart, I know that time is now, that it is right for me, for my party, and for the country. And so today I am announcing my intention to step down as First Minister and leader of my party.
Speculation is rife about why she quit, such as the impact of the pandemic and the UK's top court ruling last year against Scottish government's ability to hold a second independent referendum without approval from the British Parliament. But there's one reason that stands out the most.
Her undoing was brought about by the very controversial GRR bill, which would have given people the ability to change their gender after 3 months without a medical certificate. This outraged many feminist groups in Scotland, and it was passed with a big majority in the Scottish Parliament, but was immediately blocked by the Westminster Parliament.
Sturgeon's resignation has also raised the important question of what will happen to Scotland's independence aspirations in her absence from frontline politics. After all, she was the architect of the referendum in 2014 and has pushed for a second one since the first didn't get a majority vote.
The majority of Scots do want independence. This stepping down of the First Minister will be seen as a setback, but it's not a major setback.
With that in mind, a lot will depend on who emerges as the leader of Sturgeon's Scottish Nationalist Party. Some of the names who might throw their hats in the ring: John Swinney, Deputy First Minister; Hamza Youssef, Scottish Cabinet Secretary for Healthcare and Social Care; Kate Forbes, Cabinet Secretary for Finance and Economy; and Angus Robertson, Cabinet Secretary for the Constitution, External Affairs and Culture.
Successive Conservative governments here in London have said that the 2014 referendum was a once-in-a-generation decision and that it cannot be repeated anytime soon. In response, Nicola Sturgeon said she would turn the next Scottish elections into a de facto referendum to ramp up pressure on London to grant another vote. But without her in the driver's seat, it'll now be up to her successor to deliver what she promised. Saipur is up, London.
This is all they have to survive with for now. A little crumbling space filled with dirt and garbage. This Rohingya refugee camp on the outskirts of New Delhi is no more than an open prison for the members of the community who face constant threats and intimidation from law enforcement agencies. They say all their activities are being monitored and reported to the local police station on a daily basis. A member of the community is given that task, but that is not the only trouble. This woman says her son has been held in a detention center for months despite having a UN refugee card. With eyes full of tears and a numb voice, she revealed her ordeal.
My son was picked up by police along with his wife from outside our shanty 4 months ago. He did not commit any crime. He has been in a detention center for a long time now. I'm worried for him. The UN Refugee Agency says they are working on the case, but nothing has been done so far. He was working as a day laborer in nearby colonies. He did nothing wrong. I humbly urge for his release. We thank God that India gave us shelter, but there is constant fear of detention in the camp.
In recent weeks, the Delhi High Court ordered a joint inspection of the Rohingya Detention Center in New Delhi by officials of concerned agencies over the alleged lack of basic amenities. The court was hearing a plea of a female refugee who is facing bad health conditions due to the lack of basic facilities in the detention center.
My brother recently got married and he was detained just 3 days after his wedding along with his wife. Since then, he's in a detention center. My mother is blind and she cries every day for him. We have been living here for years and we are grateful to India for giving us refugees. I sell vegetables on the streets and similarly other men do menial work, but we are scared now since detention fear is looming across camps.
Most refugees here have heartbreaking tales of the past, and those memories of carnage and exodus are haunting them. Based on official estimates, India is home to some 40,000 Rohingya refugees, but independent reports put the figures at hundreds of thousands. Most of the refugees I spoke with feared that their identity would be disclosed, given the high risk of detention. Scores have also gone into hiding at undisclosed locations across India. They have a horrific tales of separation from their families amid a persistent deportation campaign and an intensified crackdown against the community. Munawar Zaman, the outskirts of New Delhi.
Tehran has hosted the first disaster management conference titled Strong Iran. The three-day event has brought together different representatives and experts from various organizations which are responsible for managing natural disasters at the time of crisis. The event is aimed at training responsible organizations to have proper response to natural disasters. Meanwhile, Iran's interior minister addressing the event referred to the earthquakes in Iran, Turkey and Syria and said that the country should maintain its readiness more than ever before.
These events are a warning that we must maintain our preparation more than ever in the past, and dealing with natural disasters requires a modern and not a traditional approach, and the dimensions of these events must be controlled with the help of managerial, human, software, and equipment skills.
Iran has been a very disaster-prone country throughout its history. Earthquakes, floods, droughts, inversion effects of air pollution in metropolitans have occurred many times, affected millions of people, and have claimed hundreds of thousands of lives during the past century. According to the World Risk Report, Iran is among the countries with high vulnerability in the world. More than 80,000 people have died during the past 30 years in Iran, directly by natural disasters.
The main objective of crisis management is to identify and prioritize crisis threats to formulate the best strategy for confronting the most immediate ones. Accordingly, holding such an event provides a good opportunity for officials and people to be prepared at the time of crisis. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Lives have been saved in Turkey following recent earthquakes because the country had access to heavy lifting machinery. Experts say many lives were lost in Syria because sanctions prevented the country from having similar equipment. The catastrophe has just been debated in the European Parliament.
Following the disaster, I contacted one of the largest aid agencies in Syria. I've spoken to Italian agencies and other NGOs. They all told me that the EU sanctions present an obstacle to humanitarian work.
European Commission officials told legislators that just 9 of the EU's 27 member states have supplied Syria with support. 21 have scrambled to help Turkey.
The Commission also allocated an additional 3.5 million euros in emergency humanitarian funding to help our partners address urgent needs in Syria.
This 3.5 million euro for Syrians pales into insignificance when compared to the 67 billion euro spent by the EU on Ukraine during the past 11 months. Experts have been saying for years that the bloc lacks unity when it comes to Syria.
Countries are acting in their own way. There is no coordinated action. And this is one of the reasons that we're faced with this very big crisis, this mega crisis.
Efforts by Western nations to overthrow President Bashar al-Assad have failed. Critics say interventionism has brought misery to millions of innocent people in the country. Some lawmakers want the pressure to be paused.
In Syria, there are sanctions. We don't want to see more people die in the cold. They don't have medicines. We must put politics aside and human life first.
It's been announced the EU will host a donors summit next month to gather money for the earthquake-hit regions. Political commentators are claiming it's already obvious that the vast majority of the money raised will go to Turkey, not Syria. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
In the limelight.
Lake Powell, America's second largest reservoir and one that provides water and power to millions of people in Southern California, has reached its lowest level since its first filling in the 1960s. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. USA Today has covered this story and tells us more. Lake Powell, the nation's second-largest reservoir and one that provides water and power to millions of people in Southern California, has reached its lowest level since its first filling in the 1960s. Its companion reservoir, Lake Mead, is at levels almost as low. Together, these reservoirs, fed by the mighty Colorado River, provide the water 40 million Americans depend on. Despite the storms that brought heavy rain and snow to California and other western states in January of this year, experts say it would take years of such weather to replenish western United States water resources. In 2000, the two reservoirs, Lake Powell and Lake Mead, were 95% full. They're roughly 25% full now, said Brad Udall, a water and climate scientist at Colorado State University. It's hard to overstate how important the Colorado River is to the entire American Southwest. The water crisis in western United States is now very serious. Lake Powell is the nation's second largest reservoir. It was created by blocking the Colorado River at Glen Canyon in southern Utah and northern Arizona. It stores water as part of the Colorado River Compact and produces electricity through the hydroelectric turbines in Glen Canyon Dam. Work on the dam that created Lake Powell began in 1956 and was finished in 1966. It took 16 years for it to fill. At its highest level in 1983, the lake was 3,708 feet above sea level. Lake Powell hasn't been this low since June of 1965, just 2 years after it began to fill with water. The biggest worry is if the lake's level falls much lower, it won't be possible to get water out of it. But will the water stop flowing? That's a doomsday scenario, said Bill Hassenkamp, Colorado River Resources Manager for the Metropolitan Water District of Southern California. Before things get to that point, the Department of the Interior will require reduction in water use. But how long until water stops flowing downstream? If the lake falls another 32 feet, about the amount it fell in the past year, power generation concerns become more urgent. Brad Udall said, snowmelt this spring is forecast to bring levels up somewhat. The water in Lake Powell is low because the amount of water in Colorado River has been falling for decades. At the same time, demand has risen due to increased population growth in western United States. Overall, the river's flow is down 20% in this century relative to the 20th century. More than four scientific studies have pinned a large part of the water crisis on human climate change. It's partly that there is less rain and snow, partly that as temperatures rise, plants use more water and more water evaporates out of the soil, which would otherwise have ended up in the river. In addition, the river itself experiences more evaporation. It's unfortunate that the largely natural occurrence of a drought has coincided with this increasing warming due to greenhouse gases, said Flavio Lerner, a professor of atmospheric sciences at Cornell University. That has brought everything to a head much earlier than people thought it would. Lake Mead is America's largest reservoir, a companion to Lake Powell. Lake Mead was created when the Hoover Dam was completed in 1935. It supplies water and power to Arizona, California, New Mexico, and Mexico. Lake Mead's level is 1,047 feet above sea level. You would have to go back all the way to April of 1937, almost 2 years into its initial filling, to find levels that low. It is forecast to have a new record low next summer, according to Hassenkamp. The lake isn't low enough yet to cause concerns about getting water out, but any hope of it refilling is years away, if ever, due to lowered rain and lowered snow and increasing evaporation. Some of America's largest cities depend on water from Lake Mead. It's 90% of water supply to Las Vegas, 50% to Phoenix, effectively 100% of the water supplied to Tucson and 25% of water to Los Angeles, said Brad Udall. The Department of the Interior has asked the seven states of the Colorado River Compact to come up with a plan to cut between 2 and 4 million acre-feet of water by January of this year, but the seven states weren't able to come up with an agreement. The Los Angeles Times has also covered this story and tells us more. The desiccation of the Colorado River has left Lake Powell, the country's second largest reservoir, at just 23% of capacity, its lowest level since it was filled in the 1960s. With the reservoir now just 32 feet away from minimum power pool, the point at which Glen Canyon Dam would no longer generate power for six states, federal officials are studying the possibility of overhauling the dam so that it can continue to generate electricity and release water at critically low levels. A preliminary analysis of potential modifications to the dam emerged during a virtual meeting held by the Federal Bureau of Reclamation, which is also reviewing options for averting a collapse of the water supply along the Colorado River. These new discussions about retooling the dam reflect growing concerns among federal officials about how climate change is contributing to the Colorado River's reduced flows and how declining reservoirs could force major changes in dam management for years to come. Among the immediate concerns is that retreat of the reservoir dropping below the dam's power-generating threshold. If that were to occur, water would only flow through 4 8-foot-wide bypass tubes called the outlet works, which would create a choke point with reduced water releasing capacity. There is now an acknowledgement, unlike any other time ever before, that the dam is now going to be suited to 21st century hydrology, said Kyle Roerink, executive director of the environmental group Great Basin Water Network, who listened to the meeting. They're not sugarcoating that things have to change there, and they have to change pretty quickly. Those who participated in the 7th of February meeting included dozens of water managers, representatives of electric utilities, state officials, and others. They discussed proposals such as penetrating through the dam's concrete to make new lower-level intakes, installing a new or reconfigured power plant, and tunneling a shaft around either side of the dam to a power plant, among other options. The Interior Department declined a request for an interview, but a spokesperson, Tyler Cherry, said in email that the briefing was part of broader conversations with state officials, tribal leaders, water managers, and others to inform our work to improve and protect the short-term sustainability of the Colorado River system and the resilience of the American West to a changing climate. Kyle Roerink and two other people who listened to the webinar told the Los Angeles Times that cost estimates for several alternatives range from $500 million to $3 billion. The agency will need congressional approval and will have to conduct an environmental review to analyze options. The Bureau of Reclamation's presentation given by Regional Power Manager Nick Williams included some additional alternatives that wouldn't require major structural modifications of the dam. Those options included adjusting operations to maximize power generation at lower reservoir levels, studying ways of using the existing intakes at lower water levels, and making up for the loss of hydroelectric power by investing in solar energy and wind energy. Glen Canyon Dam stands 710 feet tall, anchored to the canyon's reddish sandstone walls in northern Arizona, about 320 miles upstream from Lake Mead, America's largest reservoir. The dam has been controversial since its inception, with environmental activists and others arguing the reservoir was unnecessary and destroyed the canyon's pristine ecosystem.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Listen to the sound of silence coming from Western states and their regional allies. Nor has condemnation been heard from the United Nations as, once again, Israel has invaded Syrian airspace and killed civilians. Missiles targeted a densely populated residential area in Damascus, killing five people and injuring 15 others just after midnight local time on Sunday. Now, this has taken place while Syria is still trying to provide supplies for survivors as well as recover the bodies of victims from the 7.8 earthquake that took place on February the 6th. Now, Syria is still being punished for stopping the plans of those who wanted to create a new Middle East. Well, joining me to help me look at all of this tonight, I'd like to welcome my guest to the program. Out of Manchester, former British ambassador to Syria, Peter Ford. And out of Toronto, Zafar Bangash, director of Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome, both of you, to the program. Let's start this off with Peter. Why do you think that Israel has attacked Damascus at this time?
Well, there's been a chain of events, beginning, I believe, with American interference with Iranian oil tankers trying to gain access to markets for Iranian oil that America is trying to sanction. And in response to these American provocations, it's possible that Iran was responsible for an attack last week on an Israeli-owned tanker, or possibly two or three Israeli-owned vessels just outside the Gulf. And the third event was the Israeli attack, as reported, on a residential area of Damascus. But there's also a fourth event, which seems to me part of the series, and that was a light attack on an American base in occupied northeast Syria, one of the American bases from which they try to control Syria's oil. And I interpret this as Iran's response to Israel's awful attack on Syria.
Okay, well, Zafar Bangash, what does it mean when a foreign entity can attack the capital of a country, killing civilians, and the so-called international community does not condemn the attack or the murder of civilians?
Well, this is not surprising at all, unfortunately, because Israel has been given carte blanche to do whatever it likes in the region, whether it is carrying out missile strikes against Syria, as happened early this morning, in which five civilians were killed and 15 injured, and not just any missile strike, it was actually directed at the Syrian capital. There are, of course, you know, regrettably, what we refer to as the international community is essentially the United States and its allies, and they turn a blind eye to Israeli crimes. They also finance and arm Israel to carry out these illegal acts. I would call them war crimes. I'd like to suggest that let's reverse the scenario. Suppose Syria had fired missiles at Tel Aviv, killed five civilians and injured 15, and then consider what the reaction of, again, the so-called international community would be.
Indeed.
I can guarantee you that the U.S. president from the White House would issue an extremely threatening message to Syria, and he will warn that there are going to be serious consequences, etc., and all his NATO allies would join in the chorus and not only condemn Syria, but probably there would be retaliatory strikes. And yet here we see, despite the fact that this news was reported by most of the Western media outlets when I checked, which was Reuters, NBC, ABC, all of them carried the report, and yet there is not a whisper of condemnation from the so-called international community. So it means that this is giving the green light to Israel to continue to carry out its crimes. And of course, there are both internal reasons in Israel as well as the situation in Syria, which has been devastated by 11 years of sanctions, and now this devastating earthquake in which thousands have died, hundreds of thousands injured, millions made homeless. So Syria is even more vulnerable, and these attacks are being carried out. Of course, the Syrian foreign ministry called upon the UN Security Council, but the UN Security Council has taken no action in the past, so mm-hmm. I do not expect any action even today. So
okay.
Unfortunately, this so-called situation would continue.
Well, what about that, Peter Fort? You heard what Zafar Bangash said, that if it was reversed, it would be a totally different reaction had the Syrians attacked Tel Aviv and dealing with the United Nations. I mean, what does this say in general about the United Nations basically being silent when this has happened to Syria? The Israelis have attacked Syria after this massive earthquake.
Indeed, it is enormous. Breaking of a taboo by Israel. They crossed the red line this time. In the past, Israel has attacked Syria frequently, literally hundreds of times, but it's always been apparently attacking military targets, and targets related somehow to Iran and the help that Iran is giving to Syria. But this time, it is a blatant attack on a civilian neighborhood, a neighborhood which does house intelligence facilities, offices of Syrian intelligence. So this is a real red line for the Israelis to attack Syrian intelligence and into the bargain hit
Israelis. Is there a red line for the Israelis, though? Can you hear me, Peter? I just want to jump in here. Sorry to interrupt you. You said it's a red line for the Israelis. Is there a red line for the Israelis?
They have crossed a red line, and they must be given a lesson. And I believe this lesson is already being given, because the strike on the American facilities in Syria is a warning to the Americans that if the Israelis repeat this dreadful behavior, if they go on crossing a red line, then it's America which will pay the price, because the American forces in Syria are extremely vulnerable. It would not be difficult at all for somebody who wanted to teach the Americans and the Israelis a lesson to destroy those American bases. I think America will take the warning very seriously and will be remonstrating privately, clearly not publicly, but privately. They will be shouting, I believe, at the Israelis. The Pentagon will be angry because Israel has put American soldiers in serious danger. Time will tell. Time will tell if the Israelis break or breach a red line again. Well, we will see that deterrence hasn't worked, and then the situation will be close to outright war.
Okay. Well, Zafa, we've also seen a recent heinous attack by Daesh terrorists again in Syria, which left 50 people dead. Do you think that both attacks are a sign that Washington and its allies still haven't given up in trying to destroy Syria, or your overall assessment of this?
Well, I don't think that there is any doubt about this fact, because Daesh receives help through Turkey that is provided by many Western governments, as well as some of the Arab regimes in the region. And the fact that Daesh carried out that heinous attack yesterday, killing 50 innocent people, and then today this Israeli attack occurred, there is a strong possibility that there is close coordination between them, because both of them feel that Syria is vulnerable. I'd also like to point out that despite the fact that the United States government announced that it was lifting sanctions against Syria for a period of 6 months in order to provide humanitarian aid, but no aid has, international humanitarian aid has reached those areas of Syria that are under Syrian government control. All of the aid that is going in through the Turkish-Syrian border has gone to areas that are under Daesh control. So it's obvious that the international aid, which obviously is coming from the UN and other international agencies, is providing support to these terrorists rather than the more vulnerable people inside Syrian government-controlled areas such as Aleppo, Latakia, etc., where massive destruction has taken place. So when you ask whether there is coordination between Daesh and Israel, I would go even further and say that, yes, there is not only coordination, but that even Western governments are complicit in this. And they have not given up on their nefarious agenda of trying to overthrow the Syrian government, which obviously hasn't worked in 11 years, and I do not think it will work even in the future. But all it will do is to cause more suffering to the already greatly suffering Syrian people, and that's the real tragedy.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Yes, indeed. Well, Peter, I mean, all of this is taking place while U.S. Troops are occupying the oil-rich eastern region of Syria, where they're stealing Syrian oil and wheat. We have many reports that the American loads trucks and tankers with these items and send them over the border to Iraq. Now, what does all this mean? And should there be any expectations from the West condemning the Israelis in Syria when the U.S. itself regularly commits crimes against the Syrian people?
That's right. The American objective is, first of all, to deny Syria of its own oil. And it's a very important amount of oil. Syria was quite dependent on this area for its supply of oil, and as a result, it has to try and smuggle in oil from other places. It's a very heavy burden for Syria to carry, not have it access to its own oil. But secondly, the Americans sell the oil with the connivance of their Kurdish puppet allies. They sell it and use the money to pay for the American occupation. It's quite outrageous, but it's rather appropriate that this American base, it's called Conoco, also the name of an American oil company. It's appropriate that a warning has been sent on this channel, this oil channel, that it's America which is going in the future to pay the price for Israeli crossing of red lines.
Well, Zafa, what needs to be done, in your opinion, to stop these Israeli crimes and other crimes that are being committed against the Syrian people, since there seems to be no international community who would do anything?
Well, what needs to be done is what I believe has already been done.
So sorry, Peter, that's for Toronto. Zafar.
Yeah, okay. So just as you pointed out that the international community regrettably is not doing anything about Israeli war crimes, and nor should we expect them to do. This then places the burden on the countries in the region, particularly the resistance front, to intensify their efforts and to expand their resistance activities against the Zionist regime in occupied Palestine. We are already seeing some evidence of this, particularly in terms of the protests that the Palestinians are carrying out in the Israeli-occupied West Bank, Hamas and Islamic Jihad's activities, as well as I hope that countries like Iraq, or particularly the Hashd al-Shaabi militias, as well as militias in Syria, would join in this effort of resistance to bring an end to these Israeli crimes, because if nothing is done, then unfortunately Israel would be emboldened and would continue to carry out these illegal acts. We cannot expect much from, for instance, the International Criminal Court, although there are two cases pending before it against Israeli war crimes, but nothing, I do not expect anything to come out of there. Similarly, nothing can be expected from the International Court of Justice, although it has ruled that Israeli occupation of the West Bank is illegal. But Israel has never been constrained by legality. It is basically an aggressive colonial settler state, and nothing short of resistance, particularly from the resistance front, is going to bring an end to these Israeli crimes.
Well, Peter, your thoughts on that? It seems that Israel exacerbated to actually its crimes, not only against the Palestinians, but in the region in general. Your overall assessment, what needs to happen in order to curtail these Israeli crimes?
Well, we're dealing here with a new Israeli government one which is extremely reckless, has little experience in foreign and security affairs. So there has to be some lessons given to this new Israeli rash, irresponsible government. But these lessons will not be administered by the international community. As our colleague said earlier, it's a waste of time expecting the UN or Court of Justice to take any meaningful action. No, the only action which counts, I'm afraid, is military action. And as I said, I believe that a lesson has already been administered. A signal has been sent via Washington that if Israel continues to break through red lines, then it's American troops in Syria who are going to be killed. That's a very strong message and a very big lesson for Israel to learn.
All right, and Zafar, just about a minute for this, though. At the end of the day, it was the United States who killed Iran's General Qasem Soleimani, who was leading the fight against terrorists in Syria and in Iraq. Do you think that now, with this situation, as we see the United States and its allies are still the main supporters of terrorists, that this is becoming more and more obvious for people, not only in the region, but in the world, that it's really almost inseparable to try to separate the United States from ISIS, from Israeli crimes, basically that this Western hegemon and its allies are the ones who are actually causing the chaos in the region?
Oh, absolutely. You know, the fact that America or Donald Trump killed General Qasem Soleimani, who was the leading figure leading the fight against Daesh terrorists, is clear indication that the United States was supporting Daesh and it is continuing to support Daesh. Otherwise, why would it attack and kill a leading figure that was leading the fight against these Daesh terrorists? So it was obvious to the people in the region, but it has now become, it is becoming increasingly obvious to people around the world. And I think that should help the struggle against this hegemon and its illegal acts, especially the Israeli war crimes that are being perpetrated on a daily basis against the Palestinians as well as the Syrians in the region.
And on that note, I appreciate both of you being with us, but we're out of time. Peter Ford, former British ambassador to Syria out of Manchester, and out of Toronto, Zafar Bangash, director of Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.